I am to be awarded an order of nobility for great service to my country. Or at least because the Queen likes my wife. What do you think of that? I gasp.
Oh, I'm so pleased. I'm so very pleased for you. And for our children, too. We will be so very grand.
I pause uncertainly.
Can the King just make up titles like this?
The two of them think they can. And what is more dangerous, they do. Never was a young couple with so little power and money in more of a hurry to give it all away. And they will drive the rest of the court mad. Anyone whom she likes, or whom he trusts, gets loaded with favours. But good men are excluded. Richard, Duke of York, gets nothing, not even a civil hearing. They say they won't have him in the council now, though he is known as a good man and the best adviser they could have. But he is ignored, and worse men than he are praised to the skies. I shall be made a baron for no better reason than you keep her company.
And what name shall we have, my lord? You will be Sir Richard Woodville, Baron... what? He pauses for a moment.
Baron Grafton? He asks.
Baron Grafton, I repeat, listening to the sounds. Even after all these years in England, I still have a strong accent. I really can't say it.
But I wondered if you would like a title which came from your family. One of your family names?
I think for a moment. I don't really want to remind everyone that I'm a daughter of Luxembourg, that I'm French, I say cautiously. The mood is more and more against the French. I was telling the Queen only the other day that she should speak English in public. I am an English dowager duchess, and I am a good Englishwoman now. Give me an English name, and let our children have English titles.
Water, he exclaims, for your ancestor.
I laugh.
You can't be Baron Water.
But what about Baron Rivers?
Rivers.
He rolls the word over in his mouth.
That's fine. Rivers. It's a good English name. And yet it is a tribute to your family. Baron Rivers I shall be. And please God, one day I shall be an earl.
No. Really? Would they ever make you an earl? Would they give away so much?
My dear, I'm afraid they would give away the kingdom itself. They are not careful monarchs, and they are advised by rogues.
I mention my husband's anxiety about their extravagance as tactfully as I can to the Queen, but she tosses her head.
We have to keep our friends satisfied, she says to me. We cannot rule the country without William de la Pole. He's the greatest man in the land. And Edmund Beaufort is in such debt. We have to help him.
Richard, Duke of York, I suggest, as a man they should reward.
We cannot hold France without Edmund Beaufort. He is the only man we could trust to hold our French lands, and to restore those lands that we should return to their true owner.
Your Grace?
I'm dumbfounded at the suggestion that we should restore our lands to the French, and she flushes, as guilty as a child.
To hold our lands, she corrects herself. Edmund Beaufort is the only man we can trust.
I think that Richard, Duke of York, is the only man to successfully hold French lands since my first husband, the Duke of Bedford, I observe.
She throws her hands in the air.
Perhaps, perhaps, but I can trust no one but Edmund Beaufort and William de la Pole. The King himself can neither take decisions nor lead an army. These men are everything to me. They are the father and...
She breaks off and blushes.
Friend that I need. They both deserve the highest of honours, and we will give honours where they are due. Westminster Palace, London, summer 1449. I can tell at once that something terrible has happened. Richard comes into our private rooms and takes my hands, his face grim. Jacquetta, you must be brave. Is it the children? My first thought is always for them, and my hand goes to my belly, where another life is growing. No, thank God. It is my lord's legacy, the lands of Normandy. I don't really have to ask him. I guess at once. Have they been lost? He grimaces. All but. Edmund Beaufort has offered the French almost all of Normandy, including Rouen, in return for his safety at Caen. Rouen, I say quietly. The grave of my first husband, John, Duke of Bedford, is there. This is a bitter blow, Richard says. And all of us who fought to keep the English lands in France, nearly 100 years of long warfare, and so many lives lost, good comrades, and brothers. He breaks off. Well, we will find it hard to forgive the loss. Westminster Palace, London, spring 1450. Richard was right. Nobody can forgive the loss. The Parliament turns on William de la Pole, and his new titles and his new honours cannot save him from the rage of the English, as the men who had farmed and the soldiers who had fought in Normandy come home defeated and homeless, and complain bitterly, bitterly, at every market cross and crossroads, that they have been betrayed by their commanders who should have stood by them, as they had stood to arms for more than 100 years. In the streets, the London traders call out to me as I ride by. What would Lord John have thought of it, eh? What would your lord have said? And I can do nothing more but shake my head. I feel with them. What did we fight for? What did we die for? If the lands we won are to be handed back as part of a treaty, as part of a marriage, on the whim of a king who never fought for them as we fought for them. They blame it all on William de la Pole, since it is treason to speak against the king. And they call him to Parliament and accuse him of treason, extortion, and murder. They say that he has been planning to seize the throne and set up his little son John and his ward, Margaret Beaufort, as king and queen, claiming the throne in her right. What is going to happen? I ask the Queen, who is striding back and forth in her rooms, the long train of her gown swishing like the tail of an angry cat. I will not allow him to face the charges. He will not be demeaned by such charges. His Grace, the King, has saved him. He has ruled that he, the King, shall be judge and jury of his friend William. I hesitate. After all, this is not my country, but I really don't think the king can just step in like this. Your Grace, I think he cannot. A nobleman has to be tried by his peers. The House of Lords will have to examine him. The king may not intervene. I say that no good friend of mine will be questioned in public like that. It is an insult to him. It is an insult to me. I have demanded that we protect our friends, and the king agrees with me. William will not go before Parliament. He is coming to my rooms tonight, in secret. Your Grace, this is not the English way. You should not meet any man alone, and certainly not in secret. You will be there, she says, so they can say nothing vile about our meeting, though God knows they say enough vile things already. But we have to meet in secret. The Parliament has become mad with jealousy, and now they are calling for his death. I cannot rule this kingdom without William de la Pole.
I have to see him and decide what we should do. The king cannot rule without him. The king cannot choose a course and hold to it on his own. You know what the king is like. I have to have William de la Pole at the side of the king. He cannot be steady without William to hold him to a course. We have to have William at our side. We have to have his advice. At midnight, the queen orders me to let William de la Pole in through the little door that connects the two royal apartments. The duke strides through, ducking his head under the stone lintel, and then, to my amazement, the king comes in quietly behind him, like his page boy. "Your grace," I whisper, and sink down. He doesn't even see me, for he is shaking with distress. "I am forced. I am abused," he says at once to Margaret. "They dare to insult me. They want to rule me. William, tell her." She looks at once to de la Pole, as if only he can explain. "The lords are refusing to accept that the king can examine me alone, as you wanted," he explains. "They are demanding that I'm tried by my peers for treason. They deny the king's right to judge on his own. I am accused of betraying our interests in France. Of course, I have only ever done what you commanded. And the peace treaty demanded the return of Maine and Anjou. This is an attack on you, Your Grace, on you and on me and on the king's authority." "You will never stand trial," she promises him. "I swear it. They shall withdraw." "Your Grace," I whisper, taking hold of her sleeve, "you cannot promise this."
"I have found him innocent of all charges," the king says. "But still, they are calling for him to be tried and executed. They have to obey me. They must be made to listen to me."
"If they want you, they will have to come and get you," she swears passionately to William de la Pole. "They will have to get past me if they want to get you. They will have to take you from my chambers if they dare." I slide my hand into hers and give her a little tug. But the king looks at her with admiration. He is fired up by her anger.
"We will defy them. I will be king. I will rule how I choose, with you as my wife, and William as my adviser. Does anyone dare say I cannot do this? Am I king or not?"
Of the three of them, only the newly minted duke does not bluster.
"Yes, but we can't resist them," he says quietly. "What if they come for me? What if the lords turn out their forces, despite all you've said? You have allowed every lord in London to keep his own small army. Every enemy of mine can command hundreds of men. What if their armies come for me?"
"Could you go to France?" I ask him very softly. "To Flanders? You have friends there. Till it all blows over." The king looks up, suddenly flushed.
"Yes, yes, go now," he commands. "While they are planning their next move, go now. They will come for you and find the bird flown. I will give you gold."
"My jewels," the queen commands me. "Fetch them for him." I go as she orders and pick out a few of her smallest pieces. Marguerites made of pearls, some inferior emeralds. I put them in a purse, and when I come back to the shadowy room, the queen is weeping in the duke's arms, and he has the king's own cloak around his shoulders, and is slipping a fat purse into his pocket. Begrudgingly, I give him the queen's pearls, and he takes them without a word of thanks.
"I will write to you," he says to them both. "I will not be far, just Flanders, and I will come home as soon as my name is cleared. We will not be parted for long."
"We will visit you," she promises. "This is not goodbye. And we will send for you, and write. You shall send messages with your advice. and you will come home soon."
He kisses her hand and pulls his hood over his head. He bows to the king and nods to me and slides through the little door and is gone. We hear his footsteps going quietly down the stair, and then the muffled closing of the outer door as the king's chief adviser goes out into the night like a thief. The king and queen are cock-a-hoop like children who have defied a stern governor. They don't go to bed at all that night, but stay up by the fireside in her rooms, whispering and giggling, celebrating their victory over the parliament of their own country, praising themselves for defending a man named as a traitor. At dawn, the king goes to mass and orders the priest to say a prayer of thankfulness for danger past. While he's on his knees, praising the mercy of Jesus and exulting in his own cleverness, the city of London wakes to the astounding news that the man it blamed for the loss of France and the arrival of a penniless French princess, for rewarding himself from the royal treasury for the destruction of the peace of England, has been released by the king and is sailing away, merrily away, for a brief exile, gold in his pocket, the queen's jewels in his hat, and will return as soon as he can be certain that his head is safe on his shoulders. The queen cannot hide her delight, nor her contempt for those who say she is utterly misguided. She will heed no warning, neither from my husband nor the other men who serve the king, who say the people are whispering that the king has forgotten his loyalty to his own lords and commons, that a friend of a traitor is a traitor himself. And what can be done with a treacherous king? She remains stubbornly delighted, thrilled with their defiance of Parliament. And nothing I can say warns her to take care not to blazon her triumph in the face of people who were, after all, only calling for good government of a country that is flung about like a toy of spoiled children. I think that nothing will dampen their joyous high spirits. The news comes that William de la Pole has had to flee from the mob out of London, that he's hiding for as long as he dares at his own house in the country, and then finally that he has set sail. All over the country, there are uprisings against men who are blamed for giving the king bad advice, who are blamed for associating with William de la Pole. Then, a few days later, one of the queen's maids-in-waiting comes running to find me and says I must go at once to the queen, who is gravely ill. I don't even stop to find Richard. I run to the royal apartments, bustling past the guards on the door, shooing pages out of my way, and find the rooms in an uproar and the queen nowhere to be seen. "Where is she?" I demand, and someone points to the bedroom door. "She swore we could not go in." "Why?" I ask. They shake their heads. "Is she alone?" "The Duchess of Suffolk, William de la Pole's wife, is in with her." At that name, my heart sinks. What has he done now? Slowly, I go to the door, tap on the panel, and then try the handle. It opens, and I step inside. At once, I remember what a young woman she is, just 20 years old. She looks very small in the big royal bed, lying hunched up as if wounded in the belly, her back to the room, her face to the wall. Alice de la Pole is seated on a stool by the fire, her face buried in her hands. "C'est moi," I whisper. "It's me. What's wrong?" The little queen shakes her head. Her headdress has fallen off, her hair tumbled all around her, her shoulders shaking with silent sobs. "He's dead," is all she says, as if her world has ended. "Dead. What will I do?" I stagger and put my hand out to steady myself. "My God, the king?" Violently she bangs her head into her pillow.
"No, no."
"Your father?"
"William," William! My God! William!
I look at Alice, his widow. I'm sorry for your loss, my lady. She nods. But how? Margaret raises herself on her elbow and looks over her shoulder at me. Her hair is a mass of gold, her eyes red. Murdered, she spits. At once I glance at the door behind me, as if a killer might come in for us. By who, Your Grace? I don't know. That wicked Duke of York? Other lords? Anyone who is cowardly and vile and wants to pull us down and destroy us? Anyone who denies our right to govern as we wish, with the help of whomever we choose? Anyone who sails in secret and attacks an innocent man? They caught him at sea?
They took him on board their ship and beheaded him on the deck,
she says, her voice nearly muffled by sobs.
God damn them to hell for cowards. They left his body on the beach at Dover. Jaquetta!
Blindly, she reaches out to me and clings to me as she wails.
They put his head on a pole. They left his head like a traitor's head. How shall I bear this? How shall Alice bear this?
I hardly dare to glance over to William de la Pole's widow, who sits in silence, while William de la Pole's queen is breaking her heart over him. Do we know who? I repeat. My first fear is if someone dares to attack the king's favourite adviser, who will they come for next? The queen? Me? She is crying so hard she cannot speak, her slender body shaking in my arms.
I must go to the king,
she says finally, pulling herself up and wiping her eyes.
This will have broken his heart. How will we manage without him? Who will advise us?
Dumbly, I shake my head. I don't know how they will manage without William de la Pole. Nor what sort of world is opening before us, when a noble lord on his own ship can be kidnapped and beheaded with a rusty sword on a rocking boat, and his head left on a pike on the beach. Grafton, Northamptonshire, summer 1450. As the warmer months come, the king and queen agree to travel north. They give out that they want to be away from London during the hot weather when plague often comes to the city. They say that they want to see the good people of Leicester. But those of us who live in the palace know that the guards have been doubled at the gates and that they are employing tasters for their food. They are afraid of the people of London. They are afraid of the men of Kent. They are afraid that whoever murdered William de la Pole blames them for the loss of France, for the continual stream of defeated soldiers and settlers who come every day into every English port. There is no money to pay the London suppliers. The Queen mistrusts the people of the city. The court is going to Leicester. In truth, it is running away to hide in Leicester. Richard and I are granted leave to go and see our children at Grafton, as the court goes north, and we ride quickly out of London, which has become a surly city of secretive people whispering on street corners. There is a rumour that the King and Queen will take a great revenge on the county of Kent. They blame the very seashore where William de la Pole's dishonoured body was dumped. Lord Say of Knowle, and his heavy-handed son-in-law, who is sheriff of Kent, say that together they will hunt down the guilty men and execute them and every one of their family. They say they will empty Kent of people, will make it a wasteland. Once we are out of the city, away from city walls, Richard and I ride side by side, holding hands like young lovers, while our small armed guard falls back and rides behind us. The roads are clear and dry, the grass verges dotted with flowers, the birds singing in the greening hedgerows, ducklings on the village ponds, and roses in blossom. "What if we never went back to court?" I ask him. "What if we were just to be the squire of Grafton and his lady?"
"And our nursery of children?"
He smiles.
"Many, many children," I say. "I'm not satisfied with 8, and 1 on the way. I was hoping for a round dozen."
He smiles at me.
"I should still be summoned," he says. "Even if I were the smallest, quietest squire of Grafton, with the largest family in England, I should still be mustered and sent to war."
"But you would come home again," I pursue the thought, "and we could make a living from our fields and farms."
He smiles. "Not much of a living, my lady. Not the sort of living you want. And your children would marry tenant farmers, and their children would run wild. Do you want a dirty-faced little peasant for a grandchild?"
I make a face at him. He knows how much I prize our books and our musical instruments, and how determined I am that all my children shall read and write in 3 languages and master all the courtly skills. My children have to take their place in the world.
"You are ambitious," he says.
"I am not. I was the first lady in France. I have been as high as any woman could dream. And I gave it up for love."
"You're ambitious for your family, and for your children. And you're ambitious for me. You like my being a baron."
"Oh, well, a baron," I say, laughing. "Anyone would want their husband to be a baron. I don't count that as being ambitious. That's just understandable."
"And I understand it," he says agreeably. "But would you really want to live always in the country and not go back to court?" I think for a moment of the nervous king and the young queen.
"We couldn't leave them, could we?" I ask wistfully. He shakes his head.
"It's our duty to serve the House of Lancaster. And something else. I don't know how they would manage without us. I don't think we could just walk away and leave them. What would they do?"
We stay at Grafton for a week. It is the best time of the year. The orchards are rose pink with the bobbing blossoms, and the cows are calving. The lambs are with their mothers in the higher meadows, running and frisking with their tails like woolly ribbons dancing behind them. The hay in the meadows is growing tall and starting to ripple in the wind, and the crops are green and rich, ankle-deep. My older children, Elizabeth, Lewis, Anne, and Anthony, have been staying with our cousins to learn their manners and how to behave in a great household. But they come home to be with us for the summer. The 4 little ones, Mary, Jacquetta, John, and Richard, are beside themselves with excitement at having their big sisters and brothers home. Mary, the 7-year-old, is the leader of the little battalion, the others her sworn liegemen. I am weary with this new pregnancy, and in the warm afternoons I take the 4-year-old little Dickon in my arms for his afternoon nap. We lie down together, drowsy in the warmth of the day. When he's asleep and it is very quiet, I sometimes take the painted cards and turn them over, one after another, and look at them. I don't shuffle them or deal them out. I don't attempt to read them. I just look at the familiar pictures and wonder what life will bring me, and these my beloved children. In the day, Richard listens to the unending complaints of the people around us, the moving of a fence line, of cattle being allowed to stray and spoiling a crop.
As lord of the manor, it is his job to ensure that the rule of law and justice runs throughout our lands, whether or not our neighbours take bribes and order jurors what sentence they should bring in. Richard visits the local gentry to remind them of their duty, to turn out for him in case of need, and tries to reassure them that the king is a strong lord, that the court is trustworthy, that the treasury is secure, and that we will keep the remaining lands in France. I work in my still room, Elizabeth, my earnest apprentice, steeping herbs in oil, checking the cut and dried herbs, pounding them down into powder, and conserving them in jars. I do this by the order of the stars, and I consult my lord's books for how it should be done. Now and then I find a book I had overlooked that talks much of the aqua vitae, the water of life itself, or of burning off impurities by the touch of distilled waters. But I remember Eleanor Cobham behind the cold walls of Peel Castle, and I take the book from Elizabeth, and I put it on a high shelf. I never grow or dry any but the herbs that would be known to a good cook. Knowledge is just another thing to conceal these days. I'm hoping that we will stay at home for another month. I'm tired by this pregnancy, and daring to hope that I might spend the whole summer in the country, that the king and queen will prolong their travels and leave us in peace. We've been riding out to visit some neighbours, and come home in the sunset to see a royal messenger waiting by the water pump. He gets to his feet when he sees us, and hands Richard a letter sealed with the royal crest. Richard tears it open and scans it. "I have to go," he says. "This is urgent. I shall have to muster a troop as I ride." "What has happened?" I ask as I slip down from my saddle. "There's a rising in Kent, as any fool could have foreseen. The king commands me to ride at his side and carry the royal standard."
"The king?"
I can hardly believe that our king is going to ride out at the head of his men. His father was a remarkable commander of men at a far younger age, but our king has never worn his armour except for jousting.
"The king is going himself?"
"He was very angry about de la Pole, God rest his soul," he reminds me. "He swore vengeance, and the queen swore she would see the murderers dead. Now he has his chance."
"You will be careful."
I take his arm to look up into his face. Between us is the unspoken thought that this commander will be a young man who has never seen any sort of warfare, not even a distant siege. "You will have to advise him." "I'll keep safe," my husband says wryly. "And I'll keep him safe too, if I can. They've ordered the Sheriff of Kent to turn the county into a deer park, to drive out every man, woman, and child. There will be hell to pay. I have to go back and see if I can advise them into some sense. I have to find a way to persuade them to rule the country with some sort of harmony. They make enemies every time they address Parliament. The Queen rides through the streets of London as if she hates the very cobbles. We have to serve them, Jaquetta. We have to guide them to follow their best interests. We have to get this royal couple back into the hearts of their people. It is our duty. It is our task. It is what our lord, the Duke of Bedford, would have wanted us to do." I hold him in my arms in bed that night, and in the cool morning I find I am filled with unease. "You will just ride out with the king to show his standard. You won't go into Kent, Richard."
"I hope that nobody will be going into Kent," he says grimly.
He finishes his breakfast, and I trail out into the stable yard after him, pursuing my fears. "But if there is some kind of guard put together to punish the people of Kent, you won't join it."
"Burning thatch? Spit-roasting a poor man's cow?" he asks. "I've seen it done in France, and I never thought it a way to win loyalty. The Duke of Bedford himself said to me that the way to win a man's heart was to treat him fairly, and make him safe. That will be my advice, if anyone asks me. But if anyone orders me out in the king's name, I will have to go. I will follow you as soon as you send for me. I try to sound confident, but my voice is thin and anxious. I will be waiting for you, he vows, suddenly warm as he realizes I'm afraid. You take care of yourself and the baby that you're carrying. I will be waiting for you. I will always be there waiting for you. Remember, I have promised you. You will never look for me in vain. I tidy the house and command the servants to prepare them for my departure. I hear gossip that the king and queen have gone back to London and that the king himself has ridden out against the people of Kent. Then a message comes from Richard, written in his own hand. Beloved, I am sorry to trouble you. The king has been persuaded by the queen not to march into Kent himself, but he has ordered me to pursue the outlaws at the head of his guard, and I am doing so. Trust me that I will be safe and come home to you when this is over. Your Richard. I put the scrap of paper inside my gown, against my heart, and I go to the stable. Saddle up, I say to the household guard, and tell them to get my mare ready for a journey. We're going back to London. London, summer 1450. All the way I ride with a heavy heart. I have such a strong sense that Richard is in danger, that he's outnumbered, that the thickly forested county of Kent will hide ambushes, traps, armies of the people who will take him, as they took William de la Pole, and behead him without clergy, with a rusty sword. We take the London road in silence, but as we pass through the vegetable gardens and the little dairy farms, the captain of my guard orders the men to close up, and starts to look around him, as if he fears we are unsafe. What is it? I ask. He shakes his head.
I don't know, my lady. Something...
He pauses.
Too quiet, he says, speaking to himself. Hens shut up before sunset, shutters closed on the cottages. Something's not right.
I don't need to be told twice. Something is wrong. My first husband, the Duke, used to say that if you ride into a town and feel that something is wrong, it is usually because something is wrong. Close up, I say. We'll get inside the city before the gates close and we'll go to our London house. Tell your men to be alert and look about them. We'll go on at a canter. He beckons the men to close up, and we ride towards the city gates. But almost as soon as we are through Moorgate and in the narrow streets, I can hear the swell of noise, people cheering, people laughing, trumpets tooting, and the banging of a drum. It sounds like a May Day procession, like joy unleashed. But there must be hundreds of people on the streets. I glance at my men, who draw their horses closer to mine, in a defensive square.
This way,
the captain says, and leads us at a swift trot through the winding streets till we find our way to the great wall that runs around my London house. The torches, which are always kept burning either side of the gateway, are missing from the sconces. The gates themselves, which should be either barred for night or flung hospitably wide, are half open. The sweep of the cobbles approaching the house is empty, but there's a scattering of litter, and the front door is ajar. I glance at George Cutler, the captain, and see my unease in his eyes.
Your ladyship, he says uncertainly, better that I go in and see what's amiss here. Something has gone wrong, perhaps.
As he speaks, a drunken man, no servant of mine, weaves out through the half-open gates and shambles past us, disappearing down the lane.
Cutler and I exchange glances again. I kick my feet out of the stirrups and swing down from my horse and throw her reins to one of the guard. "We'll go in," I say to Cutler. "Draw your sword and have two men behind us." They follow me as I walk across the cobbles to the house, my London home, that I was so proud to receive and so pleased to furnish. One of the front doors is thrown off the hinges. There is the smell of smoke. As I push the other door open and go inside, I can see that a mob of people has run through the rooms and taken whatever they thought was of value. There are pale squares on the walls where my tapestries, the Duke of Bedford's tapestries, once hung. A huge wooden sideboard, too heavy to carry off, has been stripped of the pewterware that it held, carved doors left banging. I go to the great hall. All the trenches and wine jugs and drinking vessels are gone, but absurdly, the huge, beautiful tapestry that was behind the great table is still there, untouched. "My books," I say, and jump up to the dais and through the door behind the great table and up the short flight of stairs into the upstairs solar. From there it is two steps through a wreckage of precious broken glass into the gallery, and there I pause and look around me. They have taken the brass grills off the shelves. They have taken the brass chains that fettered the books to the reading desks. They have even taken the quills and the pots of ink. But the books are safe. The books are untouched. They have stolen everything made of metal, but damaged nothing of paper. I snatch up a slim volume and hold it to my cheek. "Get these safe," I say to Cutler. "Get your men to put them in the cellar and board it up and mount a guard. These are worth more than the brass grills, more than the tapestries. If we can salvage these, then I can meet my first husband at the last day of judgment. They were his treasures, and he trusted them to me." He nods.
"I'm sorry about the rest of it."
He gestures at the wrecked house, where the wooden staircase is scarred by sword cuts. Someone has hacked off the carved newel post and taken it away, as if to behead me by proxy. In the painted beams above, there is smoke blackening the ceiling. Someone tried to burn us to the ground. I shudder at the smell of the scorched plaster. "If the books are safe, and my lord is safe, then I can start again," I say. "Board the books up for me, Cutler. And take down the big tapestry, too, and anything else you find of value. Thank God we took the best stuff with us to Grafton."
"What will you do?" he asks. "My lord will want you to find a safe haven. I should go with you."
"I'll go to the palace," I say. "I'll go to Westminster. Meet me there."
"Take two men with you," he advises. "I'll make all safe here, and then we'll follow you."
He hesitates.
"I've seen worse done," he volunteers. "It looks as if they came through on a whim and took everything that was of great value. It wasn't an assault. You need not fear them. It wasn't directed at you. They are people driven to despair by poverty and fear of the lords. They're not bad people. It's just they cannot bear it any more."
I look around the smoke-blackened hall, at the spaces where the missing tapestries used to be, and the hacked banister. "No, it was an assault," I say slowly. "They did all that they wanted to do. It was not directed at me, but it was directed at the lords, at the wealthy, at the court. They no longer think that they have to wait at the gates. They no longer think they have no choice but to beg. They no longer think that we command them by right. When I was a girl in Paris and married to the Duke of Bedford, we were hated by the people of the city, by the people of France. We knew it, and they knew it. But nobody even dreamed that they could breach the gates and come inside and destroy our things. They think this now in London. They no longer obey their masters. Who knows where they will stop?" I walk out. The guard outside is holding my horse, but already a crowd has gathered and is murmuring against them. "You two, come with me," I say. "You two, go in and set it to rights." I snap my fingers, and one of the guards helps me into the saddle. "Go quickly," I urge him under my breath. "Into the saddle, and onwards." He does as I bid him, and we're away from the courtyard and some distance from my house before anyone knows we're gone. I don't look back, but I remember as I ride down the road the dark smear of the smoke stain in the hall of my house, and my realization that the people had come into my house and taken what they wanted and done just what they wished. "To Westminster Palace," I say. I want to be with the court, behind the walls of the palace, guarded by the royal guard. London no longer feels safe for me. I've become like the Queen, a woman uneasy in the heart of her own home. We round a corner, and suddenly we are swirled into a mob of people, dancing, laughing, cheering people, a great joyous May Day crowd. Someone gets hold of my bridle, and I clench my hand on my whip, but the face that turns up towards me is beaming. "Easy," I say quickly to my guard at my side, who is spurring forwards, his hand on his sword.
"God be praised, we have our champion," the woman says, sharing her happiness with me. "He's coming, God bless him, he's coming, and he will petition for our rights, and the good times will come again." "Hurrah!" shout half a dozen people in earshot, and I smile as if I know what's happening.
"Good woman," I say, "I have to get through. Let me go, I have to meet my husband. Let me go."
Someone laughs. "You'll get nowhere till he's come. The streets are packed with people like pilchards in a barrel. There's no going through nor going round."
"But won't you come and see him? He's coming over the bridge."
"Oh, come," somebody else says. "You'll never see the like of this again. This is the greatest thing to ever happen in our lifetime, in any lifetime."
I look around for my two men, but they can't keep their place at my side. They are separated from me by a dozen merrymakers. We are totally outnumbered. I wave to one. "Go your ways," I call. "I'm safe enough. You know where we will meet." Clearly, there's no point trying to resist this crowd, and our safest way is to join with them. One of my men jumps from his horse and pushes his way through to come alongside me.
"Steady on," someone says. "No shoving. Whose livery are you wearing?"
"Leave me," I whisper. "Meet me later. You know where. Don't upset them." It is the safest way, but I see him struggle to obey the order.
"High and mighty," someone complains. "The sort that should be brought down."
"Are you a king's man?" someone demands. "Think you should have everything and care nothing for the poor man?"
At last, he takes his cue.
"Not I," he says cheerfully. "I'm with you all."
I nod at him, and the movement of the crowd takes him from me, almost at once. I let my horse walk with them. Familiarly, a woman rests her hand on my horse's neck. "So where are we going?" I ask her.
"To the bridge, to see him come across the bridge," she says exultantly. "I see you're a lady, but you will not be ashamed of the company he keeps. He has gentry and squires with him, knights and lords. He's a man for all the people, of all degree."
"And what will he do for us when he comes?"
"You don't know. Where have you been?"
Smiling, I shake my head. "I've been in the country. All this is a surprise to me."
"Then you've come back to the city at the very hour of its joy. He will speak for us at last. He will tell the king that we cannot bear the taxation, that the fat lords will ruin us all. He will order the king to ignore the French slut, his wife, and take good advice from the good duke.
The good duke? I query. Who do you call the good duke now?
Richard, Duke of York, of course. He will tell the king to lie with his worthless wife and get us a son and heir, to take our lands in France back again, to send away the wicked men who steal the wealth of the country, and do nothing but make their own fortunes, and fight among themselves. He will make this king as great as the king before, and we will be happy again.
Can one man do all this? I ask.
He's raised an army, and defeated the king's men already, she says delightedly. They chased after him to Seven Oaks, and he struck them down. This is our champion. He has defeated the royal army, and now he takes the city.
I can feel a pain hammering in my head. He destroyed the king's army.
Led them on, turned on them, and struck them down, she says. Half of them ran away. Half of them joined him. He is our hero.
And what of the lords who led the men?
Dead. All dead.
Richard, I think to myself in silence. Surely the two of us did not come so far and risk so much for Richard to be ambushed by a hedge sparrow commander at the head of patchwork rebels and killed outside Seven Oaks. Surely I would have heard Melusina sing, or felt the very spheres dance sorrowfully one with another, to mourn him. Surely the man whom I have loved for all my adult life, loved with a passion that I didn't even know was possible, could not, cannot, be dead in a Kentish ditch. And I not know.
Are you ill, mistress? She asks. You've gone white as my washing.
Who commanded the royal army? I ask, though I know it was him. Who else would they send but Richard? Who has more experience, who is more reliable? Who is more loyal and honourable than my husband? Who would they choose if not my beloved?
Ah, now that I don't know, she says cheerfully. All I know is that he's dead now, for sure. Are you taken ill?
No, no, I say. My lips are numb. All I can say is one word. No, no. We crowd together through the narrow streets. I cannot get away now. Even if I could get the horse out of the crowd, I don't think I could ride. I am limp with fear, quite unable to take up the reins, even if the crowd would let me. And then, at last, we are at Bridgegate, and the crowd thickens and pushes. My horse becomes anxious at being so crowded. Her ears flicker, and she shifts from one leg to another. But we're hemmed in so fast that she can't move, and I can't dismount. I can see the Lord Mayor of the city, as he leaps up on a milestone, balancing with a hand on the broad shoulder of one of the city's guard, and shouts to the crowd.
I take it is your will that Captain Mortimer and his men enter the city.
Yes, comes the roar. Open the gates.
I can see that one of the aldermen is arguing, and the Lord Mayor gestures that he shall be roughly taken away. The guards throw open the gate, and we look out through the gateway beyond the drawbridge. On the south side, there is a small army waiting, standards furled. As I watch, they see the gate flung open, hear the encouraging bellow of the crowd, see the red of the mayor's robe, and they unfurl their banners, fall into ranks, and march briskly along the road. People are throwing flowers from the upper stories of the buildings, waving flags and cheering. This is the procession of a hero. The drawbridge is dropped before them, and the clang as it goes down is like the clash of cymbals for a conqueror. The captain at the head of the men turns, and using a great sword, slices through the ropes of the bridge so that it cannot ever be raised against him. Everyone around me is shouting a welcome. The women are blowing kisses and screaming. The captain marches before his army, his helmet under his arm, his golden spurs sparkling at his boots, a beautiful cape of deep blue velvet rippling from his shoulders, his armour shining. Before him comes his squire, holding a great sword before him, as if he's leading a king, entering into his kingdom. I cannot tell if it is Richard's sword. I don't know if this man is wearing my husband's hard-won spurs. I close my eyes and feel the coldness of the sweat under my hat. Could he be dead, without my knowing it? When I get to the palace, will the queen herself comfort me? Another widow at court, like Alice de la Pole. The Lord Mayor steps forwards, the keys to the city on a scarlet cushion, and bows his head to the conqueror, and hands him the keys. From all around, crowds of men are spilling out of the city gate to fall in with the soldiers behind the captain, and they are greeted by his army with slaps on the back and settled into rough ranks that march past us, waving at the girls and grinning at the cheers, like an army of liberation come at last. The crowd follows him. I swear if he marches on Westminster at the head of such a crowd, he can seat himself on the king's marble throne. This is a man with the city in his hand. But he leads the way to Candlewick Street, where the London Stone stands proudly in the street to mark the very heart of the city. He strikes the stone with his sword, and at the ringing sound the crowd bellows in exultation. "Now is Mortimer the lord of this city," he shouts, and stands by the stone, holding his shield in one hand and his sword over his head, while the men cheer him.
"To dine,"
he declares, and they all move with him to Guildhall, where the Lord Mayor will spread a dinner for him and his officers. As the crowd goes with him, eager for the offcuts of beef and the broken baskets of bread, I slip from my horse, take hold of her reins, and lead her carefully out of the crowd, hoping to creep away unnoticed. I edge down a side road and then into a smaller alley. I am almost lost, but I climb on a step and struggle up into the saddle and turn east, letting the slope of the street take me towards the river. I remember when I was a girl on my way to England, I was lost in the forest, and Richard found me. I cannot believe that he will not come looking for me again. It doesn't seem possible that I should have touched him for the last time, kissed him for the last time. And now I cannot remember the last words I said to him. At least we parted lovingly, I know that. I cannot remember the words that we said, nor how we looked, but I know that we parted tenderly, because we always parted tenderly. We used to kiss each other good night. We would kiss each other at breakfast. He was always loving to me, even when he shouldn't have thought of me as anything but his lady. Even when I trapped him into giving me our child and insisted on a secret marriage. For 14 years he has been lover and husband, and now I am afraid that he is lost to me. I give my horse her head and let her pick her way through the maze of dirty streets. She knows well enough where the Westminster stables are. And I don't care. When I think of Richard dead in a ditch in Kent, I want to lie down in the gutter and die myself. I put my hand on my belly and think of the child who will never know her father. How can it be that I shall not show Richard his new baby? It is growing dark as we come to one of the many back gates to the rambling palace. I am surprised to find no one on sentry duty. I would have expected the gates to be closed and manned with a double guard, but it is like the king to be careless, and without my husband, who would command the guard? "Hi!" I shout as I come close. "Hola! Open the gate!" Silence. Silence. where there are usually scores of people coming and going. Silence, where I would have expected a shouted challenge. I rein the horse in, remembering that when you